And of course, the area I've been speaking about, extraterrestrial contact, may not say there are people who have had unusual contact with extraterrestrials who are being very quiet about it and continuing that relationship on behalf of humanity. So I think somewhere at the end of 1977 we had a great watershed in human history, and somewhere way down the line in the future people will look back and say, yes, that's when it happened. But it happened so quietly that the world is not aware of it. They're too busy with shootings and crime and war and markets and all that sort of stuff to pay attention to the real things that were going on. Yeah.
Would there be any aspects beyond the Icelandic papers, the group itself, a type of journal communication between themselves which they would have open to those who are deeply interested to follow exactly what's going on with them?
Did you hear what he said? Is there any continuation of communication between these workers since all these books were published? The answer, unfortunately, is no, in a way. The fire of physics underground was smashed to pieces because the editor, Ira Einhorn, was accused of murdering his girlfriend, and her body was found in a trunk, mummified and desiccated, and he skipped the country, nobody knows where he is, and we have some reason to believe that he was framed. I know you may think this is all funny, but I have a letter here, and I'm not going to do a Joe McCarthy thing on you, but this letter is from the, this is intercepted letter, just I'm not supposed to have this letter. This is from the National Defense Department of Canada. It's from the Operational Research and Analysis Establishment, Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, and it's dated 17 November 1978. And there's a whole letter that analyzes how deadly, dangerous our group, the people I'm talking about, is to the welfare of Canada and the United States. I don't want to go into all the details of how bad they are, but I want to point out that here it says the cast of characters involved in upsetting the status quo. And at the top of the list is Tom Bearden, nuclear engineering, that's his background, nuclear engineering systems evaluation, psychotronics, UFOs. And Tom had his book called Excalibur Briefing blocked for 2 years. His publisher's printing establishment had fired 17 times in those 2 years, which held up production. The editorial offices were broken into by burglars 3 times looking for Tom's manuscript. They never got hold of it, etc. Tom eventually got it published, but he had to pretty much pay for it himself. The next on this notorious list is Andrea Kuharis. And I'm listed as being an MD in Interneurology, ESP, and Tesla. The next person, the next criminal on this list is John G. Taylor, mathematics. He's from the University of London. And if you know anything about his career briefly, he was part of this research effort in the beginning. And then he wrote a book and he denied that he'd ever seen any metal bending after publishing 3 books on it. And he had never seen any psychic phenomena, etc. What happened is he was what we call chicken. He sold out the British Ministry of Defense, gave him a big fat contract to do research on ELF, and he just dropped out and said he never worked with us and all that. But that's public history, well known. Another fellow on this list is Jacques Vallée, the UFO scientist. And I think Jacques sold out too under heavy pressure. He wrote a book called, Messengers of Deception. I don't know if you've read it. It's an absolutely bizarre book, totally unlike any of his previous writings. And if you want to be, if you're curious at all, you should read the book because, for example, in this book I come out to be a big Nazi. And UFOs aren't real anymore. After writing 7 books on UFOs, they're German invention, and they're being flown all over the world by former Nazis. I mean, the whole thing is absolutely insane. But anyway, that's... Alan Hynek is on this list, and you all know who Alan Hynek is. But strangely enough, Alan Hynek has continued to do his work. He's had no problems, no pressure. And sometimes I wonder if his name just wasn't dropped into this list, because he doesn't really belong into this group. Ira Einhorn is the one who is listed as a psychic potster, with a big question mark. And he's the one who organized and got together the Far Out Physics Underground group, did the editorial work, collected all the papers and circulated them. And anyway, he's been put out of business very effectively. I might add, somebody who's had the same treatment who's on this list is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And I believe she was set up with the whole bomb business in order to discredit and destroy her. But she has survived, and she's doing her work just as effectively as ever, and not really bothered by it. Other people on the list are Hazel Henderson, Carter Henderson. I don't know if you know any of them, but they are from Princeton, New Jersey, and they sponsored a lot of meetings of groups like ours, and mostly in futurology. And there are other people on this list. Anyway, that's what I mean by that sort of thing. It's not really important, it's just you expect this sort of thing. And the main thing is these people who are out to crucify others are not that smart. Usually you can smell them coming, you can take care of them. I've had problems, but I've never really had any personal problems with all this stuff. And maybe I've been lucky. Now let's see, we're going to get on to the next phase. The next crucial phase here, I think that all of you will be interested. Remember that there's a time frame here. I'll just put the book.
I'm sorry, can you give us the publisher of that book by Carl Gruber?
Yeah, it's Dell Publishing.
Thank you.
Is there anything out from the Electromagnetic Line Information Conference, a book or a publication?
No, what I've chosen is this. How are we doing on time? Well, let me just put down one more line and we'll have a break. Remember I told you that there's a period of December, and it's not exact because it's between these two dates when Rosh comes. And as far as we know, Rosh is the head of the 24 civilizations. And that apparently, according to the material I have, will be an event that not too different from what Benjamin Cream has described. Condition, I'm not saying this is a messiah at all, but this figure will be seen by all. What that means exactly, I don't know. At least it means that it won't be a private or secret visitation to the earth. I've had no more information since this material was given as to how that appearance will occur, so I can't really honestly tell you anything about it.
Andrea, will be the Antichrist
has
been accepted? When is it going to occur?
We have no firm date or timetable on the avatar, whether he be the Hindu type of avatar or the Judaic type of Mashiach. I do know that, and some of you are aware of this, that in India, there is that expectation of an avatar returning, and of course they think of it purely in their own terms. The Jews in Israel, when you get off on the side streets and get out of the main stream of daily political and military and business life, the pious Jews certainly expect the Mashiach to return. And when I last talked to some of the rabbis in the Neisharim section of Jerusalem, they felt that man would have to go, or at least Israel, always being kind of the pivotal point of this kind of pressure, would have to go through a major war before the Mashiach would appear. In other words, it would be the most crushing time of their national existence. Now, that war has not come about. I mean, the Lebanon War, in their eyes, is a minor affair. The Yom Kippur War in October 73 was not a major affair in their minds, because they knew it was coming and they just simply let it happen because they didn't want to offend world opinion by again clobbering the Egyptians as they did in the 67 war. And of course it was all neatly contained in a few days. So the war that they speak about has not come about. That's, now again, I'm saying it's a local opinion. That's Jewish opinion in Israel. It's not the same in Brooklyn or in Montreal or Los Angeles. That's strictly from the very Orthodox people in Israel. When you have somebody like Benjamin Cream come along, as you know, he reflects totally the tradition that starts with Blavatsky, comes through Alice Bailey, and down to our time. So he's reflecting that point of view solely. My own feeling is that some kind of world leader equivalent to what is the avatar, the Mashiach, whatever, will appear. And as you know, Benjamin Cream says he's here already, he's in London, he's a businessman, he's walking around doing his daily transactions, etc., etc. I don't really know in which form or how. I believe he will appear, but I don't know how myself.
And by the way, the traditional image of the Mashiach is that he will come and take out people on some huge birds, which coincides with the idea of the
Yeah. Anyway, there's going to be a lot of opinion about all this, and I'm sure a lot of you have your own ideas, and some of you have your own channeling sources of information. I think, personally, we should just listen to each other and wait and see what happens. I have no idea. All I know is this source said this, and really all we know is it's an initiative or some kind of a name, and I'm just personally just waiting. I'm not changing my life particularly. I just wait and see what happens. Somebody, oh, you had a...
I just want to mention in the Bailey book, the return to Christ, it mentioned that the great parents would come and the Messiah would come through airplanes. Now, would this mean esoterically that it would be, you know, the extraterrestrial?
I don't know. There are many interpretations like that. The whole spectrum ranges all the way from the individual appearing to a total change in consciousness, which will, you know, be that manifestation. I don't really know. I wish I knew. I wish I had some way of... I mean, you can all have your own belief systems, because there's no proof for any of these things. As you gather, I'm the type of person who has to have some kind of proof and knowledge and has to fit some overall structure. So I really don't know, and I really don't want to, you know, put my opinion on you as being any more valid than anybody else's belief or opinion. I believe it's going to happen. How exactly, I don't know. It may even be that one of these children who is born is going to pop up like a jack-in-the-box and be it and surprise everybody. I don't know, really. But I think that kind of... Let me just give you my opinion, which is all it is. I believe the presence of a Christ figure is necessary on earth during a period of terrible pressure and change, because any such change, if it's going to be effective, that is, lasts, has to be under the guidance of a much higher power than any of us can imagine, one who encompasses the whole earth and literally sees man through this evolution as a kind of a guiding, healing kind of a force. I mean, that's just an opinion. I can't really... Anyway, why don't we just take a break? And Norman is going to start the meeting by making a few announcements.
Thank you.
I'm going to finish up the clock messages today. Not much left. And tomorrow we'll have a kind of an open discussion about the question that Norm has raised. What can we do? What should we do here for 2 hours? And then with the meeting tonight at the community club and the discussion tomorrow, some of us thought that it might be good to have the core group meet afterwards as those who specifically are going to be leaders of various parts of what's discussed tonight and tomorrow. There's the action to be taken. So we'll kind of have a wrap-up meeting after the morning seminar tomorrow, perhaps from 11 to 12, something like that. We can decide, we can have it here, I don't know, we'll decide where to have it by tomorrow. Okay? Now to continue with the overall timetable, there's two main points left to put down on the schedule. I had forgotten to put down this date. I just thought I had already said it, but for those of you who may have forgotten, this year. Now we have here the 80-month period, and I have to put that over here. And this is the period we are now entering. And that ends on August 17th, 1988. And the new period begins on September 9th, 88. And the important thing is that these 24 days here are going to be the crushing end of this pressure on earth and living things.
Here in the new ones in the tectonic plate of the earth. For example, the almost ascent of Lewis Fault, that's an old crack, and it's well known. But for example, the crack from Mount St. Helens down in Mammoth Lake and further east and south is one that has been inactive for several thousand years. And that's the sort of thing I mean by new cracks. And these may be into the Arctic ice caps, they may be in the Pacific, the Atlantic, the Indian Ocean, I don't know where, as some indication that the first major crack that will appear in the coming period is in the area east of Australia between the Indian Ocean, or I'll just say this is the Eastern Indian Ocean. That would be the first major part of the earth. It would be so major that you won't miss it. Everybody will know about it. Now, speaking about cracks, a lady here reminded me that this morning on the news, I was listening to the Today Show, that there was an announcement from the Buffalo News, the TV station, you know, local news from the Today Show, that there was a loud boom in the Niagara area. I don't know exactly where it was heard, but I don't know the area that well. And the police were asked what it was all about, and they said they had no real information. All they know is it was
not a sonic boom. Is anybody in Buffalo this morning in the area? What was that all about? Anybody know? Did you hear it? Well, I was listening to the news around 7:20, so it must have happened in the wee hours, before that. I don't know. They didn't give the exact time. Anyway, you can check on it. I don't know whether... I have no idea what's going on locally, so... be interesting to find out. Let me just then put down the period here. From here on, the new age begins, and that the new life will start growing again. When I say new life, I'm talking about life in the sea, life in the mountains, life on the plains. There will be. Well, I've talked to experts in wild plants, for example, in South America and Northern America on the west coast up to Alaska. And they say some 7 or 8 new species of plants have been discovered in areas that were fairly well known. And I've talked to sea people, and they say that these are not species that have been overlooked, but new kinds of species of life are already appearing in Earth. So, it may be that some of this new life that can survive the difficult times ahead is already beginning, but again, that's a highly specialized area in which you have to know all the existing plants to be sure that the plant you see is really a new plant, not something that's been overlooked. So that sort of thing is going on already. The other event that comes with the new age, which I've already mentioned, is the Holy of Holies that comes down. My interpretation of Earth, which has to do with a spaceship. So the messages that I'm reading to you end in this particular way, and I'll read them slowly if you want to write it down. I quote, "Above all, from 1978 onwards, listen to us, be attentive to us for these 10 years, that is until 1988. It's signed by Aleph, and there's a definition under Aleph of what title goes with Aleph, and it just says the prime source of the 5 plus 7, which equals the 12, of the 9 times 0, which are the 9, but 9 times 0 is 0, as you know, so it's a very strange phrase. I'll repeat that again, of the 9 times 0, of the 9 hidden principles. Now, this message, incidentally, was being given at this point in February 1976. So I quote again, "Until we reach you in 1980, this is the," and the Hebrew word is ephod, which means the oracle. And this message terminated on February 27, 1976. And then there was a subscript to that signature which said, quote, "By decree of the 9, the eruptions and explosions for the earth begin." That's what I referred to before as the labor pains of the earth. Now, there were no messages from 1976 until 1980. And sure enough, just like clockwork, make a pun, the messages did begin very early in 1980. And they're long and they're complicated and they continue to this day. But they're all technical and not general. In other words, they refer to very specific things about the children. For example, I will get a precise latitude and longitude where a new child is either being conceived, or is going to appear, and I'm given certain dates and times because I have to do a little looking around and delivering and counseling people. So that kind of work has been going on, or advice, since 1980. And then when major crises occur, and as I mentioned before, every once in a while, some military man decided the time has come to let loose a few bombs, and my group and I have to go to work on that problem. And these crises never seem to end. And for those of you who weren't here, as I've told you, I'm just repeating, we've had 13 clear nuclear alerts where we come within 5 minutes of letting the SAC fleet go on their missions with sealed orders not to return. And that's the kind of world we live in. And that has nothing to do with all the accidental warnings that we get of Russian missiles coming in. So that's a very nervous, tottering situation. And if the public knew about it, I think they'd all scream and tell their respective governments to stop it. This is playing the ultimate Russian roulette with humanity. But that's the kind of world we live in. So that's the kind of messages that come through. They're just practical little messages of things we have to do, usually on a kind of an emergency basis, and about the children. The information that comes through about secret knowledge is all very clever and contrived and always amuses me. As I say, we're working on various aspects of energy, of life origins, of healing, of treatment, and so on. And what happens usually is that somebody has been working in a quiet backwater for 10, 15, even 25 years in the case of one scientist, and he's never been able to do anything with his material because nobody quite understands it. And then we are led to them, and then we form a partnership, and we continue the research with additional resources, with additional help and that sort of thing. Again, it's a quiet work, it's not public. Some of us get up every once in a while and get papers about it, but nobody usually understands what we're saying, and we don't try to explain it. We just let it drop, knowing that we have to be at these meetings for certain people to pick up this knowledge and develop it. So I don't want to make too big a mystery of it, make it all very esoteric, but I'm afraid that's the way the work of the world must go on, very quietly in the recesses and not in the full glare of publicity and controversy and all kind of expectations which are not part of the straight line mission that we're involved in. Now, I haven't given you much of a time today, which I apologize for, to have an interaction and discuss these things. So we use this time now before we close to get into some discussions. Yes.
The geologists have proof of the various changes of the magnetic rock and south poles. Is my understanding this is what is going to be occurring, that there will be an extreme change of the magnetic pole, so the shift of the Earth will occur at this point. Would you speak to that?
Yeah. I want to just say specifically, I have no information. Everybody's through with this already. I have no specific information myself from the clock data that there will be a shift in the magnetic pole of the Earth. But that doesn't mean that's not going to happen, because this information keeps coming in continually, as I say, and usually it comes in when we really need the information. Now, about the pole shift, what this lady means very specifically is that we have a magnetic pole of the Earth, north and south, sorry, that's a little off, and it is known that the magnetic pole of the Earth, there's a spin axis, incidentally, that is not the same as the polar axis. The true spin axis of the Earth is something like this, and there's a number of degrees of difference between these two. This is the axis on which the Earth spins, and this is the magnetic axis. It's been known that starting somewhere in the mid-Pacific, over millions of years, the North Pole of the Earth has wandered from here to here to here to here, and it's gone over here and it's gone as far east as eastern Hudson Bay, and then it's come back, and this has been plotted pretty accurately, and of course now it's right there. Now, there's several explanations of this, just so you don't confuse the shifting of the magnetic pole axis with the shifting of the spin axis. These are two different things. With respect to the magnetic pole axis, as I described earlier, you all know that the Earth is a kind of solid substance, the stuff we feel under our feet is rock. Over a magma layer, which is kind of viscous and sticky, and a center liquid core of high temperature, it is possible, for a lot of reasons, for the surface of the Earth to spin without the core changing. In other words, the slippage to the spin axis remains the same. With respect to the magnetic pole axis, as I described earlier, you all know that the Earth is a kind of solid substance, the stuff we feel under our feet is rock, over a magma layer, which is kind of viscous and sticky, and a center liquid core of high temperature. It is possible, for a lot of reasons, for the surface of the Earth to spin without the core changing. In other words, the slippage to the spin axis remains the same as far as the core is concerned, but this part can move. And some of the polar shifts can be explained in those terms, in that if you take very deep cores here, and most of these are deep core sediments, you could be getting a readout of where the magnetic axis of the Earth was, irrespective of where the surface of the Earth is. Now, to get a true polar shift, you have to get this part to shift, not this part. And that can pretty much only occur if a huge body comes by. Moon being such a body, which may have been captured in orbit, or a large comet goes through the space, let's say, between the Earth and Venus. And there are some bodies that are being followed very closely by astronomers. One is called Al-Toro, which is a small comet, which zips. It's called Al-Toro because it has a kind of an axis like this. It usually passes between the Earth and Mars, and sometimes it comes fairly close to the Earth. And it's a large enough body that it could cause perturbation. If this thing by accident, or by its spinning, its curvature orbit characteristics, does come very close in conjunction with other planetary alignment, it is possible for a small body like this to cause perturbation. But anyway, a lot of astronomers are watching all those things, and I think if a comet comes anywhere near Earth's orbit, there'd be a lot of people watching it, and maybe it's a good place for our military to send our nuclear bombs out into space to ward off some of these things. Although the probabilities of a direct hit are not too good, considering that the orbits are not well known. Anyway, that's something that's probably in the works, but as I say, I have no direct knowledge of that. If the flip of the Earth does come, though, I just might say that the tidal waves just caused by even a minor flip would be something like 5,000-6,000 feet wells of water sloshing around the Earth for some time. So that would be a pretty good bath for the Earth, I would say. But again, we don't know too much about that. Anybody else have any more knowledge about this than I do that might finish the picture? Yes, you will. Oh.
Well, one thing I might ask about is, which I think also coincides with some polar shift, is the ice age 10,000 years ago. And I was curious, since you have a 6,000 year cycle, how the ice age fit into that.
Mm-hmm. The the cycles that we're talking about, the basic measurement is, again, the Earth has a precession. This is the North Pole, the Earth star. The Earth wobbles around in its precession. In other words, its spin axis wobbles this way. And that wobble completes a complete cycle in something like 25,920 years. And if you divide that number by 4, you get a little over 6,000 years for the cycle. And it's not a fixed cycle. Now, why does this number have anything to do with these so-called 6,000 year cycles? Well, whoever built the Great Pyramid, if you look at the Great Pyramid from the side, and this is north here, you know there's a shaft. I can't give you the exact, it's 26 degrees off of the horizontal. But anyway, this shaft goes down like this into the Great Pyramid. And then it goes into these other chambers here. Well, if you look out at this shaft, and it's not very big, and you look straight out toward the stars, and I've taken photographs of this, you will see that this points directly at Alpha Draconis, which is one of the circumpolar stars. In other words, the true North Star is here, and then there's a bunch of, look at this as a clock face here, and then there's a bunch of other stars around it. And right now, you're looking up, the shaft is pointing at this point. There have been whole books written about this, you can look it up. Anyway, if this is a clock in the sky, and the clock hands take 25,920 years, right, to go around. And if you know the true science, if you know where zero is, you should be able to look up this shaft and determine where on the clock we are in terms of time. Now, from my own clock data, and I haven't gone into this, zero point is at what we call 9 o'clock on our clocks, not 12 o'clock, okay? And so you would start a cycle of 25,920 years around here. This thing is now pointing right now, to be very precise, at this point here. So I interpret this as meaning that we're at the end of a 25,920 cycle. However, the Mayans, to get more directly to your question, did not calculate by this method these great cycles. They calculated by another method. Every 19 point, somebody may have to correct me, I forget the exact number. I think it's something like every 19.86 years,
there's a conjunction of, I forgot, is it Jupiter and Saturn, or Jupiter or and Venus, Jupiter and Venus, fixed conjunction. The Mayans used this as their true clock basis, not that clock basis. So they counted up 52 of these conjunctions, gave them a great year, and I can't remember all the math at the moment, but this, when I could figure it out roughly, it's roughly 20 into 5,200 years. I've forgotten all the written data. Let me see if I can give you this. Every 250 of these conjunctions would add up to 5,200 years, and they usually expected the catastrophes to occur in 5,200 year cycles. And this is the way they record them. It's not 6,000 years. So if you go to different civilizations, you find they, and I've talked to my mentors about this 6,000 year cycle, and they said it's only approximate. It doesn't, it's not a precise rigid cycle like the Jupiter-Venus conjunctions of the Mayans. And it can be shorter or longer. And also, sometimes you skip a whole so-called, in quote, 6,000-year cycle. In other words, when nothing happens, when everything is orderly and precise, when you don't need to do all this expansion of gases and so on from the Earth. So the cycles are not rigid, okay? Just to make that clear. Anybody else? Okay, well, why don't we call it a day, and tomorrow we'll specifically discuss what we can do. Real tough morning to get up and get going in this lovely gentle rain and the nice cool air. So I suspect that we'd be a little late this morning. Some of you already know the outline of what we're going to speak about in terms of what can one do in the face of this forecast, seven hard years, which are going to be like a spiral that turns tighter and tighter as we get near the end. And I will perhaps briefly outline some of my ideas, and I hope it'll be helpful, and then we'll have a general discussion about it. Now, the usual idea of survival is the kind of thing that I and my colleagues did in 1974 and 75 when we began to understand these things. And I'll tell you what we did, but this is what you should not do. We just assumed that the Earth platform where we were would remain stable, and that all we had to do was be like squirrels, part off a lot of nuts, and then we'd be okay, which is very stupid thinking when you stop to really analyze it. But that's the kind of thing people naturally go through. And so we said, well, we're a research group, we do a lot of laboratory work, and we need power. We could always use candles for a light, but we need power to operate complex instruments. So we said, when the electricity goes, we're in trouble. So like idiots, we bought a 50,000 watt generator for $36,000 and installed it. And it was nice because when the local power supply would go out, it would automatically cut in. But the whole thing was an absolute waste of time because, as events turned out, number one, the platform did not remain stable. Number two, we were in fact, as I've indicated, kicked out of it for complex reasons, and the whole thing went up in smoke anyway. And we did the same thing with huge underground fuel storage tanks, right? It's going to be cold, you got to have heat, so you put in fuel, and so on and so on. And we got cars that would run on diesel instead of gasoline, and this is the kind of thinking, unfortunately, that we're all prone to, and I think the $100,000 or so that we expended on this kind of preparation is all wasted, and I hope it will be a lesson to some of you who may have such inclinations. And as you know, the Mormons really, in a way, have this kind of thinking, and I admire the Mormons. This is not a criticism of them. But as you know, they've always had in their history usually a three-month food reserve and fuel reserve and so on. And then about 5 years ago, they upped it to 6 months. And about 3 years ago, they upped it to a two-year supply. And I don't know exactly where they're now, but there are a lot of Mormon families with about a two-year supply of food stored in their basement. But this is not the sort of thing that we should be thinking about. I think you should assume that in a period of great crisis and stress, as in all human history, people do not remain rooted. They begin to wander. The great migrations of the human race, whether it be from an ice age coming or from terrible crops or the plague or whatever, always are heralded and carried out by migration. Now, the first thing you're going to see when times get bad is people are going to be accelerating the current trend in migration. As you know, people are leaving Canada and they're going down south, and people in the east in the United States are going west or the southwest. Some of them are going to other countries where prices are cheaper if they have some kind of stable income. So what has been going on is going to accelerate. But it's not going to be in grand, big, streamlined campers that have television and washing machines and hot water supplies. It's not going to be that way. You're going to either get out with the little car you have and go as far as you can, depending on the amount of fuel available. And all of us remember very well October, November, December of 73, when the Arabs just arbitrarily shut off the oil spigot. And I know, as an MD in the state of New York with all the special privileges and license plates, there's one period I couldn't get gasoline for a week. And I was supposed to, you know, be entitled to privileged consideration. So that's the sort of thing that we have seen. It's just going to be worse. So ultimately, if you're thinking I hate personally to even use the word survival, but I guess the best one we have. But as mankind goes through this metamorphosis, as we go through one stage after another, with the increased pressure, ultimately we're going to have to rely solely on ourselves and our own powers. And of course we're going to have to support our immediate family, whatever that may be, wife, children, relatives, parents, etc. And that immediately tells you about the range of possibilities of what can be done. Now, the first thing that people think about, well, I got to have enough money to get from here to there and so on. Well, the problem with that is everybody learned in Germany after World War I is when times really get bad, money becomes useless. I mean, what we have now as inflation is nothing compared to what would happen in a real crisis. Oh, we're going to have a chicken stew. What first thing you do is go out and steal a chicken. You might belabor that point further. But even if you're resourceful and crafty and so on and can live off the land, the biggest problem is the breakdown of yourself. Now, there are a lot of people, as I already mentioned, who don't want to be survivors, who don't want to see the new age. They just soon cash in their chips and walk out of the game of life. And I think you'll find the majority of people are that way, at least in my sampling, talking to people. Most of them say, look, I don't want to be around when those hard times come. I mean, and people who are spiritualists can very easily accept that philosophy because they know that death is really just a minor transition, that it's not of any great significance. And so to cash in your chips and walk out of the game is not too difficult because you're not really clinging on to anything in life. A lot of people who are more materialistically minded
do please the light, and when light is unpleasant, they take the easy way out. So I'm not even going to talk about the people who, and they're being a majority, I'm afraid, who are just not going to even try. They're just going to roll over and play dead. But I'm talking about the people like yourselves who are really interested, excited at seeing this enormous historical transition of humanity toward a higher state of evolution. And I know that you're normally conditioned to think that the petition to God is going to help immediately. Well, I think in a normal course of events that does work. But we're talking about an abnormal course of events where the overall plan, if I may use the word, is to allow human beings to find their own way through this crisis, whether it be in the mode of death, which is certainly there, whether it's for the mode of transformation that some of the Christians teach, you know, the rapture, or whether it's hanging in there and helping everybody else who wants to get through and wants to see it and wants to help and hopefully wants to have contact during the worst period with the higher beings who are behind all this. So these are the kind of three paths that are open to us. And I'm only going to speak about the third path. I think the Christian, particularly evangelical leaders are telling you every day all over the world by television and radio about the rapture part. And the first part nobody talks about because that's kind of the unthinkable part, right? So we're only going to talk about the third part. So, the most important thing is to become strong in yourself. Now, there are many ways to do this. As a farmer who lives out in the middle of a tough Wyoming desert prairie and is somehow getting enough water and fighting all the elements, winter and summer, is a survivor. He knows how to live off the land. He knows how to scrape up the water. Even though it's scarce, he knows how to farm in such a way that he can defeat the elements. He doesn't use wet farming, he doesn't use irrigation, he uses dry farming, etc. And he raises the kind of animals that will provide him with food, like chickens for eggs and goats for certain kinds of wool and sheep and so on. And he's not the one who's raising the fat Aberdeen Angus who are going to wind up on the place of the most luxurious hotels in the world. Well, that is a good example of a survivor, except it's a kind of a grim survival, as we all know who visit people like that, both in Canada and the United States, Mexico, and so on. I think survival should be more than just holding your body and soul together without any aim, without any purpose, without any sense of accomplishment other than surviving per se. And so I think it has to be both a physical and a spiritual type of survival. And the physical survival simply means to be tough. It means you can withstand cold, you can withstand heat, and you can withstand thirst, and you can withstand for a long period, and surprising how long people can go without food, without, let's say, even for a week. And at the same time, be able to sit down and meditate and pray and somehow come in contact with the source of all life which is all around us. And not only that, but transmit that to others who are around you in the form of healing energy, consolation, comfort when somebody else falls in the march. That's the sort of toughness I'm talking about. And as I mentioned the other day, I think the best model we have for that way of life is the old pre-Christian Essene, or Essene, way of life. And there are a lot of books around about how they lived. They're very simple. They had one piece of clothing, they had a shovel to bury their excrement, they didn't want to mess up the landscape. They had communal meals, which are very simple. And they apportioned the work in the community, and of course the key to their whole existence, as you may remember, was to get out of the whole realm of desire. And because of this, they withstood all hardships without complaint.
even when they were captured by the Romans and tortured, they went through the torture smiling, as though these poor, pitiful people who were torturing them were really to be blessed for whatever reason. In other words, they never broke down. They always maintained a wholesome, healthy, creative type of spirit. The other element of their life, which I personally think is very important, but this is each person's decision, is that the Essene way of life, in accordance with this idea of not having any desires run you, you run yourself, was to live a life of celibacy. Anybody who came into this order had a year in which to kind of make the transformation from a normal sexual way of life to a celibate way of life. And if they could somehow do it, then it's not easy. They would then be put on a 3-year probation, and at the end of 4 years, if they, as we say today, had it all together and were balanced, desirous individuals who were still happy, creative, helping other people, then they would be allowed to become full-fledged members of the Ascetic community. Now, that monastic idea is widespread in the world. You can pick models from China, you can pick all kinds of models from India, where they have umpteen forms of schools and disciplines that carry out the same principles ultimately. You have the great Catholic experience of several thousand years. And even in very primitive cultures, like the Jivaros, for example, in Ecuador and Peru, they still have a very rigid way of life for those who become the heroes, the shamans of the tribe, and they live a life apart from the normal life. So these are some of the basic approaches to being strong, self-sufficient, survive anything. Socrates, I think, is a good model if you remember when he was a soldier in battle, and of course in those days everybody who was a free man was a soldier just as in Israel today. And many of his colleagues would comment on his so-called stoicism, that is, in the midst of battle, in the midst of cold, in the midst of hunger, he just went around as though everything was normal, hunky-dory, apple pie, and just kept everybody cheered up and happy. So anyway, Socrates, as one of the wisest men who ever lived in our Western tradition at least, himself lived that way of life. All the other allegations brought against him, which led to his death, I think were probably phony and trumped up and just used as an excuse to get rid of him. So that's the idea for the self. Now that holds not only for young, healthy people, but it holds as a discipline that must be extended to children and to the older people who have, of course, need more help. But this holds throughout a cross-section of human being and experience. It may be all right for myself or you as individuals say, okay, I can do this and you go at it. Many people here probably don't for such disciplines. But it's another thing to tell a 4-year-old or a 10-year-old or 70 or 80-year-old people to assume these kind of hardships. But I think these things can be done, as we know from examples here and there. Amongst humanity in historical times and present times. So personal strength is built on only one foundation, willpower. Now willpower is not some kind of Nazi thing or Nietzschean idea essentially. It is something that all of us exercise. When I say I'm going to move my arm out here, it's an act of will. Something in my head says, move this complex mechanism. And very little parts go into action when I do that. I trigger them. If I get a little further in my work and I concentrate on this piece of metal, and I'm not going to do it for you, but I can't put, and have it bend in my hand, just droop over, that's another form of willpower. And if I, for example, love pork or chocolate, awkward or whatever. And I say to myself, and I'm now talking to my stomach, I'm not going to have you because, you know, you've got too much of a grip on me. You're running me, I'm not running you. That's another act of willpower. And so it goes to our sleeping habits, our sexual habits, our working habits, our relationship with other people. We learn to exercise that willpower. Now, willpower is something that's never been defined adequately. It's something we all experience. We all know what it is. But there's a lot of, I think I indicated this several days ago, there's a lot of research coming out of this new physics of consciousness, which is beginning to define in a way that we can understand what willpower is, what information is, what ideas are, and what creation is. But this is basic to all of us, but somehow it's unless we're on a very enormous power trip, and I'm talking about the kind of people who have to conquer counties and states and countries and financial realms and so on, or Olympic records, unless you're in that particular category of people who are enormously driven for some power end, we don't normally really exercise our willpower very much. So if I have to leave any word with you, if you start doing your own training on your own will, and that's the most important thing you have to do in terms of metamorphosis and what's coming. I think all of us can look in ourselves and realize we could all make a checklist of 101 little weaknesses that we could very easily override if we wished with will. But we're just lazy and there's no real incentive and we don't do it. But having some kind of goal in front of us, which is to get through this metamorphosis that's going to start in 7 years and go on for some 20-odd years, it might be an important thing for us to start with. That doesn't require any organization, anybody else. It only starts with you, and it can be very effective. And as that builds up, you can, you know, really get strong. And you can, instead of taking hot showers every day, you can take cold showers, and you can sleep underground or in a sleeping bag instead of a nice Simmons mattress. And you can cut off the television when you really want to see it, and the movies, and all sorts of other little props that kind of hold us together like a house of cards. And when you get rid of all these little props, you'll find that you're much clearer of mind, in memory, in action, in purpose, and intent, and you're much more on your own wherever you find yourself. It may seem strange, but there are circumstances in life right now where any of us, when we leave here and go out on the road, something happens. We have all of our credit cards stolen, our money, our identification, and we're suddenly out on the road and we're hitchhiking. We're nobody. We're trying to beg our way to get somewhere. It's happened to me. I mean, just like that, it can happen to you. So, if you're really self-reliant, you look upon that as an adventure, not as a big tragedy. And eventually you'll get to where you're going, and you'll get all your credit cards back, and you can write another check, and you can start running the way we normally do. But the idea of just something that you can do as an exercise, just walk down the road. Don't take any money, don't take anything, and just live off the land for a day or two. It's a very, very good experience. And until you can do that sort of thing easily and with grace, you haven't really conquered the will or the sense of self-security. Most of us are all propped up with 1,000 wonderful gadgets, and